Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Thanks for tuning in to Behind the Knife. Kevin here. For those of you bold enough to chase the pinnacle of surgery, yes, I'm talking about vascular surgery, we have just the thing for you. Our vascular surgery oral board review packs 72 high-yield scenarios from carotid stump syndrome to a AAA with a horseshoe kidney and everything in between. Whether you're gearing up for your vascular rotation or the oral boards, we've got you covered. Access it anytime, anywhere, right from the BTK app. Enjoy the episode, and as always, dominate the day.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us for today's episode of Behind the Knife. I'm Luciano Del Bono, and joined by my fellow residents, Andrew Huang, Carolyn Judge, and our faculty, Dr. Frank Davis, and our program director, Dr. Robert Beaulieu. Today, we'll be discussing the management of type B aortic dissection with a focus on the increasing use of TVAR in uncomplicated dissections. We'll spend about 10 minutes on a brief subject overview and then spend the remainder of our time discussing controversial and nuanced decision-making. And we will end with quick hits to reinforce key concepts. So to begin, Carolyn, could you briefly describe what type B dissection is and how they are classified?
Absolutely. I'll first define an aortic dissection, which is the propagation of a potential space in the intimal medial layer of the arterial lumen caused by an intimal tear. Blood tracks into this space, creating a false lumen, which can expand proximally or distally. The Stanford classification system historically categorized dissections as type A if they involved the ascending aorta and type B if they were distal to the left subclavian artery. More recently, the Lombardi classification system was developed, which divides the aortoiliac arteries into zones 1 through 11 and names dissections according to their proximal extent or entry tear and distal extent. The Lombardi classification system defines a type B dissection as one with an entry tear distal to the left subclavian.
Great. So moving more to the clinical realm, let's talk about how these patients will typically present. Andrew, do you mind taking this?
Yeah. The classic symptoms of aortic dissections include tearing chest or back pain that is commonly with severe hypertension. Additional symptoms may reflect malperfusion of branches of the aorta, including the viscerals, the spine, lower extremities, and the renals. And it's important to differentiate dissections that present with or without malperfusion as it determines a patient's course in the hospital. A dissection that presents without malperfusion is called an uncomplicated dissection compared to those that present with malperfusion, which is called a complicated dissection. Malperfusion occurs in about a third of dissection patients, with about half due to mesenteric ischemia and the other half due to lower extremity ischemia. The 30-day mortality with visceral ischemia is about a third of patients despite surgical management, that compared to 1 in 10 patients without visceral ischemia. These malperfusion events are about 80% dynamic and tend to occur in patients who are generally younger, but usually these present emergently.
Wait a second, Andrew. What do you mean by dynamic? What's the difference between dynamic and static?
Yeah. So a dynamic outflow obstruction is generally one that occurs at different parts of the cardiac cycle, obstructing the entry to a visceral vessel, versus one that's static is one that's there and consistently pressing and obstructing the vessel.
So are you just trying to come up with a fancy way of saying the flap moves when the heart beats?
Yes.
Awesome. All right, go ahead. Yeah. Back to your description of how we work these patients up.
So the physical exam is extremely important. You have to go through a pulse exam to assess for signs of distal malperfusion, acute limb ischemia, and an abdominal exam. These findings generally help correlate what you would expect to be seen on further steps, including imaging.
Okay, great. So now you suspect somebody who has a type B dissection. How would you approach this person if they present to the ED?
So generally, classically, you would start with evaluation with the chest x-ray, but it should be noted that about a third of patients with an aortic dissection have a normal study, and only about 43% of patients with a type B dissection have the classic widened mediastinum. Cardiac gated CTA is generally the gold standard to evaluate which vessels are patent and which ones are not. And in the OR, we can use something called intravascular ultrasound to allow for accurate device sizing for initial measurements, since many times the non-invasive imaging such as the CT can be confounded by hypotension. Also, echocardiograms can be used to evaluate type A's, but really in these type B aortic dissections have pretty limited value. When going through these modalities, the most important aspect on deciding what to use during your workup is to determine whether there is a type A component and whether further cardiac evaluation is required and whether or not there is any radiographic evidence of malperfusion that corresponds to your physical exam.
Great. So kind of bringing this back, so how would you define if somebody has a complicated or an uncomplicated type B dissection?
So a complicated type B dissection is whether or not there's a presence of any features that define complications, such as rupture, malperfusion, or high-risk features. High-risk features will define as an initial aortic diameter that's greater than 40 millimeters, radiographic evidence of malperfusion, such as malperfusion of a renal or asymmetric contrast enhancement of that kidney, an entry tear on the lesser curve, which is at higher risk for rupture, and bloody or a pleural effusion or hemothorax, refractory hypotension or hypertension for greater than 12 hours despite three medications, or refractory pain, or if this is a readmission from a previous evaluation of a type B aortic dissection. An uncomplicated dissection is generally medically managed with impulse control. This is classically with either esmolol, different calcium channel blockers such as nicardipine, or vasodilators, as needed to achieve a blood pressure with a goal generally less than 120 over 60 to reduce the aortic wall stress and to prevent further dissection. It should be noted that complicated dissections, again, as stated before, is about a third of cases that are considered surgical emergencies. And patients presenting with severe hypotension and shock generally have a 60% overall mortality with a 29.3% mortality for those who undergo surgical intervention.
Awesome. And just to add one thing there is if you are initiating them on antihypertensive medications, you typically want to start a beta blocker first before a vasodilator to prevent reflexive tachycardia. But let's go into a case now. So 6-year-old patient presents to the ED with back pain and hypertension. On imaging, they're found to have a type B aortic dissection without signs of malperfusion or distal limb ischemia. What are your considerations for managing this patient, Frank?
Yeah, thanks, Luciano. I mean, I think this kind of is really where the rubber meets the road. And we were talking about patient cases here and how you take the data that Andrew has talked about and Carolyn's talked about, how you manage these patients on their presentation. So the case that Luciano just talked about, a 60-year-old patient presenting to ED with back pain, imaging suggesting a type B dissection, but without, that's the key thing, evidence of malperfusion or distal limb ischemia, that is by definition an uncomplicated patient, uncomplicated type B dissection. And initially, it's appropriate to get pain control to get that patient comfortable. Hypertensive control, as Andrew appropriately pointed out, with beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, all to get that blood pressure down to that goal of less than 120. But in addition, beyond starting those medical managements of an uncomplicated type B dissection, I'd also want to know if there's any other high-risk features of this quote-unquote uncomplicated type B dissection that would get me concerned that it might transition into a complicated type B dissection.
So before you go on there, do you mind kind of going into more detail about what you mean about these high-risk imaging features?
Yeah, of course. So even though patients might present initially as an uncomplicated type B dissection based upon imaging criteria and you're trying to manage their blood pressure, things that get me concerned that they're going to fail that medical management are some of the imaging criteria, such as if they present with initial aortic diameter of on the dissection of greater than 4 centimeters or 40 millimeters, those patients are at higher risk of failing medical management and progressing onto a complicated version. In addition, I also look at the diameter of the false lumen, not necessarily the true and false lumen together, but solely the false lumen diameter. And if that diameter is greater than 22 millimeters, again, studies have shown that that predisposes patients to likely fail typical bread and butter medical management. Other things you want to look at is there a full thrombosis or a partial thrombosis of the false lumen? Partial thrombosis of the false lumen has been associated with continued progression of the aortic size and progression of the dissection. So that's another one that I'd be on the lookout for that standpoint.
Yeah, great. So back to your management strategy. Yeah. How would you continue sort of managing this patient that is uncomplicated?
Yeah. So what I do is there, you see them in the emergency department, you get your imaging findings, you start them on your pain control, you start them on your antihypertensive regimen, and then you're going to want to admit them to the ICU, right? Because you need to have hourly and minutely monitoring of this blood pressure and make sure you're titrating those medications appropriately to keep them within that sweet spot, less than 120 for systolic blood pressure. Then then the next 24 to 48 hours, like, you're going to want to re-image that aorta to confirm the stability of that aortic dissection and confirm there's no further progression of the dissection. If that's true, then I'd start to slowly titrate their IV medications that you have mounted for drips onto oral medications, again confirming that you can keep them in that 120 to less than 120 range for systolic blood pressures while making that transition. If during that transition they continue to display absence of pain and keep appropriate blood pressure management, then you can work towards maybe a discharge to the uncomplicated type B dissection. If at any point during that algorithm, though, their pain ratchets it up, they can't control their blood pressure, then you need to reset. And you need to say, has this now transitioned from an uncomplicated to a complicated type B dissection? So you have to keep your sensors up at all times, and that's why they're in the ICU there.
So apart from pain, are there any other labs that you would look out for?
Well, I mean, I think that's also when they came in the ED, you're going to get your typical CBC, you're going to get your typical basic. You'll start with an ABG, and you're looking at your creatinine to make sure there's no change in renal function. You're following your lactates to make sure there's no signs of visceral or end-organ ischemia from that standpoint. You'll get those labs daily. And again, if those change, then again, you have to reevaluate, has this made a transition over from an uncomplicated to a complicated type B dissection?
Awesome. So going back to our scenario, let's change this up a little bit. So now we have a 65-year-old patient who complains that they have significant abdominal pain as well as back pain. Now the imaging shows that there is a dissection flap that extends into the SMA. Bobby, do you mind kind of walking us through the management for this type of patient?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the management has really changed based on what we found from the International Registry of Acute Aortic Dissections, or the IRAD database. Michigan was a big contributor to this database, but it's an international registry, so it's across the globe. And essentially what it helped to do is move the paradigm from treating complicated patients with aortic dissection from open to endovascular, showing that TVAR, or thoracic endovascular aortic repair, has a better survival rate than open repair in these patients. And a lot of people kind of wonder, how does that work? I mean, we're talking about malperfusion into a visceral segment now, and we're really only covering up a small area in the chest of this dissection with a graft. And what we're essentially looking to do is identify what we call the initial entry tear, or the area highest up on the chest where that aorta demonstrates that intimal flap that is allowing blood to get into the dissection plane. And our goal is to extend a graft that covers that and hopefully lands in healthy aorta up top. With that, we're hoping that we can promote aortic remodeling. There may be some adjunctive procedures that you have to do in this case. So we know malperfusion is likely going to force us to the operating room. And what we do specifically after that depends on what the CT scan looks like. We want to try to cover the entry tear and land in an area of relatively normal sized aorta. So that may involve covering the subclavian. In emergent cases, you can proceed directly to the operating room with covering that subclavian, and that's an acceptable risk. In cases where you may have a patient who's on the complicated, uncomplicated threshold, you may have time to do something like a carotid subclavian bypass, which is generally receives a class one recommendation to do before TBAR, in which you're considering covering the subclavian to both reduce the risk of spinal cord ischemia and posterior stroke. Or you may be able to use an adjunctive endovascular procedure such as a thoracic branch device or even laser fenestrating something on the table. And all of those sort of extend out of where we need to cover that primary entry tear. Certainly, when you're doing a TBAR, the goal is to allow for aortic remodeling over time by pushing that dissection flap over. And so we really have to also talk about the timing of doing things. As you stated earlier, acute malperfusion is a surgical emergency. We got to get that patient in the operating room. Otherwise, they're going to have gut malperfusion and they're going to die. And I think a lot of what Frank talked about in terms of impulse control, pain control in a full set of labs, those tenets certainly hold true, but we're going to generally get that patient into the operating room and perform a thoracic endovascular repair. And we're going to do that with groin access most typically. We use the intravascular ultrasound to confirm that we're in the true lumen. A little takeaway, if you're getting pimped or anything on your rounds about what's the true lumen and what's the false lumen on a CT scan, in general, the true lumen is the smaller of the two lumens. And we usually pick which side we access based on which iliac has flow from the true lumen, because it just makes it much easier. But you do have to keep in mind there are fenestrations maybe up and down this entire thing that could allow your wire to traverse true lumen to false lumen, back to true lumen, and anything like that. And so having an IBIS is really important.
Is there a classic trajectory that the true lumen kind of dissects, or like the aorta dissects forming like the true and false lumen?
Yeah. Thank you for the leading question. You know, we typically think of the sort of spiral pattern of dissection. And often the sort of term that the left renal is left out sort of helps you to visualize that spiral pattern. We'll often see that dissections that involve the visceral vessels, mostly the celiac SMA and right renal, will tend to come off the true lumen with the left renal coming off the false lumen. And that's all kind of like anecdotal, but it tends to kind of hold true. Once you get down to the iliac system, a little bit more, all bets are off. You may have dissections that involve both iliacs, that don't involve the iliacs, that stop in the paravisceral segment. And so it's really important to personally review these CT scans before proceeding to the operating room. But in general, you're going to want to get these patients back in there quite quickly.
Mm-hmm. All right. Awesome. I guess my other question is, even with just covering the entry tear, I know there's talk about sort of extending some of these grafts, trying to get better apposition down closer to the visceral section.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to let Frank take some of the adjunctive measures that we can do. But in general, answering your question about where we extend these grafts down to, we get worried about covering a lot of the thoracic aorta in normal aneurysmal disease because we don't want to cover lumbar arteries and increase your risk of spinal cord ischemia. In general, when we're talking about treating patients with a type B dissection, we're often talking about taking your primary T-bar graft, so that covered graft, down to about the celiac because it helps to promote aortic remodeling the best. You do want to try to keep the celiac intact if you can and not cover across it, though there are some cases where because of an aneurysmal degeneration acutely in the setting of your dissection, you do have to extend that down. But now we're sort of fighting at the fringes about the teaching lessons here. And the most important part is you just want to try to get these tears covered so that you can allow the aorta to start going back to remodeling. But I won't take the cool stuff away. Frank, do you want to talk about any of the petticoat or aptly named techniques?
Sure. I think Bobby appropriately pointed out, like, the most important thing is covering the proximal intratear with a covered T-var graft. But in addition, to help long-term for these patients to prevent aneurysmal degeneration, to prevent chronic dissections progressing to persistent aneurysms, there's been a multitude of different studies and designs for different grafts that have sought to promote positive aortic remodeling. So I guess the two primary strategies that help to prevent treatment failure and help promote positive aortic remodeling, one is called the petticoat technique and the other one is called the stabilized technique. So super fancy names from the super fancy trials, but let's go through each one by one. So the petticoat technique involves both a composite device. So what this composite device is the proximal or the highest end portion of the device is actually a covered proximal T-var component. The second part of the composite device is a distal part that's a bare metal component that actually extends through the visceral segment to continue to promote positive aortic remodeling and expansion of the visceral segment of the aorta. And it's important, as you can imagine, that's a bare metal stent because you can't have a covered stent covering all your visceral segments. You'll get massive ischemia. So the distal bare metal stent exerts a low radial force pressure while also allowing for future reinterventions. Say in the end, the patient eventually develops negative aortic remodeling, aneurysmal degeneration, you can still go in there from an endovascular standpoint. So it allows you to still have options. And the old mantra, in at least in vascular surgery and other surgical specialties, is that you want to fail forward. So if your primary option long-term in patients doesn't necessarily work, how can you set yourself up for the secondary intervention that might need to happen? And the two trials that really founded the petticoat technique was the STABLE 1 and STABLE 2 trials that demonstrated that the petticoat's efficiency was improving visceral perfusion in the acute period in both uncomplicated and complicated dissections. And the second strategy for promote positive aortic remodeling is what's called the stabilized technique, or this also stands for stent-assisted balloon-induced intimal disruption. So stabilize, much cooler. And what it involves is it's a combination of both the petticoat technique, but also the balloon rupture of the dissection flap itself. Because that dissection flap between the difference between the true lumen and the false lumen is actually what you want to open up or expand to allow for full aortic remodeling. So in this case, you actually put in the bare metal stent and use a balloon to assist in rupturing that dissection flap to allow the bare metal stent to fully expand to the overall aortic diameter. And again, the whole purpose of these two techniques is to allow for positive aortic remodeling, preventing the long-term aortic mortality for patients, whether it's aneurysmal degeneration or future aneurysmal and aortic rupture from this dissection, the weakening in itself.
Yeah, and I think the really important part that we haven't really talked about all that much just yet is the timing of all of these things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, certainly our complicated dissections were taken immediately to the operating room or quickly to the operating room. And the uncomplicated we're managing medically, though we talk about some high-risk features such as that initial aortic diameter that's going to prompt you to consider a repair early. But what does early mean? And we've traditionally divided this up into three different categories of timing. One is the acute phase. The second is the subacute phase, and the next is the chronic phase. And really what we're talking about with the acute phase is this 1 to 14 days, so 1 to 2 weeks, where the aorta is incredibly friable and at high risk. The wall itself, that flap, is highly mobile and can make it very challenging in uncomplicated cases to get the remodeling that you're looking for. Now, that being said, there are ongoing studies looking at how early we can intervene on these things to promote early remodeling. But a lot of that is where these petticoat and stabilized techniques come into play. Because if you can imagine at the distal end of your T-bar graph, so that one that's furthest down, if you've got a hypermobile flap that's going up against a rigid T-bar, you may create a distal tear or a stent-induced new entry tear, a D sign. And so that may actually put you at a higher risk of having visceral malperfusion. And so we really get a little bit nervous dealing with these acute phase. It seems like the subacute phase, the 14 to 90 days, is where we may have a lot of room to improve. You still have relative mobility of the dissection flap, but it's much more stable. And so you have the opportunity to perform an intervention that would not be at high risk for that distal tear. And then beyond 90 days, you kind of get in this point where the flap actually becomes thickened and more difficult to move to the side. That area of chronic remodeling and how you influence the dissection flap when you have that thickened realm, but a low radial force stent with that petticoat technique that was talked about, that's another area that we're really exploring too. So despite the relatively easy recommendations to say you surgically fix something that's complicated and you manage medically something that's uncomplicated, we've now introduced a lot of these considerations in which you have to take timing into account. You have to see how far you're going to extend your graft, if you're going to do so with an uncovered graft or a covered graft, and how that's going to affect your long-term results. Ultimately, what we care about is aortic related mortality and complications.
So before we move on, or I guess to regress to the malperfusion, I just wanted to ask about the iliac malperfusion in particular and how you approach the management of that and when you consider fasciotomies.
Yeah. So I guess that's important to think about, right? Because one aspect of malperfusion, people get very concerned, or rightfully so, about visceral malperfusion, renal malperfusion, but also lower extremity ischemia is a significant portion of malperfusion that can present with patients with dissection. So with patients who have lower extremity malperfusion, and after you put in your T-VAR, they restore flow, patients can get profound ischemia reperfusion syndrome. So I think it's really important that when you're taking a patient to the OR to restore lower extremity ischemia, not worrying about the aorta and all that is great, but you also need to understand how long have they been ischemic for this, their lower extremities. If it's true that they've been ischemic for more than that 6-hour time period and you restore blood flow to their lower extremities, as with any trauma-based case, you should be doing bilateral lower extremity four-compartment fasciotomies, because that's the only way to prevent significant muscle swelling and prevent significant ischemia reperfusion injury from that standpoint.
I feel like some of these patients are hard to tell because usually they come in either already sedated. So what do you do in that case where you don't really know what the initial time frame is for limb ischemia?
Yeah, great. I mean, the great question. I think if you're ever thinking about should I or should I not perform a fasciotomy, the answer is you should always perform a fasciotomy. Fasciotomies have minimal morbidity if you do them, but if you don't do them, it can have significant mortality risk for the patient. So if you're ever hemming and hawing back and forth, do the fasciotomy while you're in the OR. I think it's the long term, it's going to be more beneficial for the patient.
And the other consideration is sometimes some of these patients are, you know, what we say, kept down or intubated and sedated after the procedure too. So you may not get a reliable exam on them afterwards. It's not that you can't take them to the operating room if you notice that you have some swelling in the lower extremities, but these patients may get a significant resuscitative effort that can cloud that picture a little bit. And if you are delaying that because you're not picking up on the early signs of compartment syndrome, such as paresthesias or paralysis because they're the intubated and sedated, you may miss your window to really save that anterior compartment, which tends to be at the most risk.
You brought up renal malperfusion. At what point do we typically intervene?
Well, so renal malperfusion is a tough one. Everybody likes to think that if you have malperfusion to the kidneys, that's an indication for repair. But what does that really mean? Does it mean if you go into acute renal failure?
Sure.
That one's pretty easy. What about a creatinine that bumps from 0.9 to 1.3? Is that malperfusion? By the definition, it's probably malperfusion. But those are the patients that people tend to be a little bit more okay managing conservatively and making sure that their kidney function starts to rebound. Some of these patients come in hypotensive. I mean, they're in screaming pain. They don't really eat or drink for the rest of the day, or they're in the hospital system not getting IV fluids. And so it may just be that you actually have an acutely hypotensive patient who's got an acute kidney injury because of that. So there's a lot of nuance when you're considering renal, isolated renal malperfusion. And I think it's one of those things that I wish I could give you a straightforward, normal answer to is what you do for everybody. But you have to consider probably the longitudinal view of creatinines over time. And I don't mean days, but hours type thing. Okay, y'all. So Frank and I are going to turn the tables on you a little bit, not to put you on the spot too much for in front of your program director, but why don't we leave them with a couple quick hits that are going to let us have some of those maybe abside or V-side questions that tend to show up a little bit in regards to this. So Carolyn, I'm going to hit you first. What is the primary benefit of the Lombardi classification system you discussed earlier?
That would be localization of the entry tear.
Yeah, super important. We talked about needing to cover that. So that's really good. All right, now, Andrew, what's the biggest predictor of the failure of medical management in acute, uncomplicated type B aortic dissection?
It would generally be the in-aortic diameter that's greater than 4 centimeters.
Right. High-risk feature seen on that initial CT scan with an aortic diameter greater than 4 centimeters. Great. And then, Luciano, what's the ideal timing to treat these endovascularly with the TVAR?
Yeah, so kind of getting back to what you talked about earlier, it's usually the subacute period from about 14 to 90 days while that septum is still relatively pliable.
Awesome. That's exactly right. Obviously, if you have to treat them because of malperfusion syndrome before then, get it done. But if you have the time to wait, that 14 to 90 day window seems to be a really good time to intervene. All right, Carolyn, last one to you. What's the most common familial syndrome associated with aortic dissection?
I believe that would be Marfan's.
That's correct. Yeah, Marfan syndrome. So that also leads the way to talk a couple other genetic aortopathies worth discussing. Both Louis Dietz and vascular Ehlers-Danlos have the risk of dissection associated with it. Those patients are a complicated group to manage. They tend to present younger in life with vascular disease such as dissection or aneurysmal disease and other distributions. Certainly the aorta is at risk for all of them. We usually like to do open repairs when we're talking about other visceral beds for these patients, but this may still be an area where you talk about getting patients acutely managed with a type B aortic dissection with an endovascular approach. So a little bit of a departure from how you would normally do it. But I'd say anybody that you have that's young that comes in, certainly under the age of 40, but you may even in that 40 to 50 range, who has a type B aortic dissection that's not related to something like cocaine use or an obvious trigger, such as a trauma. These are patients you really strongly have to consider a genetic workup for. And I definitely have my eye on Marfan syndrome as one of the key predictors or risk factors.
Awesome. Well, I think we've talked pretty in depth about type B aortic dissection today, and I feel like I've learned a lot from some of our vascular specialists here at University of Michigan. So I wanted to thank everybody who participated. I would also like to thank Behind the Knife for the opportunity to participate, and go blue.
Dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.